This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Julia Tymoshenko is 23 years old. She lives in Kyiv, Ukraine. Julia grew up, though, in a village about an hour from the city, the youngest of generations of her family who've lived on that land.
When I think about the history of my family and when I think about Holodomor, which is Stalin's famine, artificial famine, and I have family stories of the Bolsheviks coming into their houses, taking food away. Then I have family stories about not being able to use Ukrainian language and having to use Russian in different spaces just because Ukrainian was forbidden. If I go back and more in, back into the history, I have stories of my great parents being Cossacks and fighting for Ukraine's independence against Russian Empire. It's almost like the more you go back, you still see the same kind of issue.
To Julia, that same kind of issue is Russia imposing its will violently on Ukraine. Today, Julia says that same kind of issue is Russia's deadly war on Ukraine that's now in its eighth month.
As a 23-year-old who just like started a career in college and you're sitting in a capital of a country that is like growing, that is becoming digitalized, modern, and you're realizing that there are tanks right now of another country and soldiers marching towards your city. It's super difficult to comprehend, but it felt like this historic struggle of all generations before me just flashed in front of my eyes. And almost like I felt the pain. That was the moment when I realized I could be the first generation that wasn't affected or whose life wasn't ruined by Russia, who could grow up in a modern free Ukraine, free from this just constant fight. And I realized that in that moment, that hope was completely gone.
That moment was Russia's invasion of Ukraine on February 24th, 2022. Julia chose to stay, even though she'd been to college in the United States and had friends abroad who offered to shelter her.
It felt really wrong for me to leave the country when it's like really something important happening here. And I also have seen all of people around me doing something to help. This like sense of unity was completely unparalleled. So I felt like if I leave, I will miss such an important moment in my country's history.
That's Julia Tymoshenko, 23 years old and living in Kyiv, Ukraine. Well, joining us now is Timothy Snyder. He's the Richard C. Levin Professor of History at Yale University, a renowned scholar on Ukraine. He's recently written a piece in his Substack called How Does the Russo-Ukrainian War End? And he joins us today from New Haven, Connecticut. Professor Snyder, welcome back to On Point.
Glad to be with you, Meghna.
I also want to note that you've been writing and researching Ukraine for many, many years, including your 2010 bestseller, Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. And first of all, Professor Snyder, tell me a little bit about what you hear in 23-year-old Julia's recollection, her family recollection, of Stalin in particular, as she's thinking about Ukraine's current fight against Russia.
What she's reminding us of is a history which was silenced in the Soviet Union and still not fully apprehended beyond Ukraine, beyond Eastern Europe, which is the history of the political famine of 1932 to 1933, in which about 4 million inhabitants of Soviet Ukraine were starved as a result of political decisions made in Moscow, deliberately starved to death. It's one of the most horrible atrocities of the 20th century. Raphael Lemkin, who invented the word genocide, referred to it as a typical Soviet genocide or a classic Soviet genocide. But in speaking about this history, she's also making a very interesting point, which is that her generation had the hope, and I would like to think still has the hope, of getting out of the past, knowing the past, respecting the past, remembering the parents and the grandparents and the ancestors, but finding a way into the future. You're talking to someone who's 23 years old, so she was born in about 1999. The generation that runs Ukraine now was born in the late 80s or early 90s. They're people in their 30s and 40s. They're trying to get Ukraine into the future, and in this government, at least, doing a pretty good job of it. And it's hard not to see the Russian invasion, which is horrible in so many ways, also is being horrible in the sense that it's trying to just stop people from getting to the future, individuals, families. It's trying to stop Ukrainians from moving into a world which is better than the past, and just to take them back down, to force them back into a past which they'd like to get, which they'd like to get out of. Another really interesting thing in what she says, and this is just very broadly true, is that Ukrainians want to be in Ukraine. Despite the horrors, despite the war, the major impulse has been to go back to Ukraine, to do what you can to help. And one of the reasons that Ukraine is winning this war is what she mentioned, that everybody is doing something to help. It's not just the government ordering soldiers to the front. It's people like her and like her friends all over the country organizing informally in order to make sure that the soldiers have what they need.
Mm. You know, we're going to spend much of the hour talking to you, Professor Snyder, about daring to think how the war might end right now. But before we do that, I do want to just, again, lay a foundation about the centuries even that presaged this moment in Ukrainian history and why, you know, to your point, Russia, it seems as if Russia feels like it wants to stop Ukraine from advancing as a nation. Because just check me on something. When Julia said that, you know, she was hoping to grow up in a modern, free Ukraine, and then she said free from just a constant fight with Russia. I mean, how constant has Ukraine's resistance to Russia been?
I mean, let me try to put that into a couple of contexts. Number one, when we think of the history of that part of the world, we're generally doing so through an imperial Russian framework. There's an imperial Russian story that, if we know anything about this part of the world, we know that story. It's the story that Putin tells in a very simplified and vulgar version. And in that story, there's always been Russia. There's never been Ukraine. Russia goes back 1,000 years. There was a baptism in 988. Magically, that baptism created this eternal nation, Russia. No one else has a right to tell the story or talk about this story. Russia's a great power. It always has been, and so on. This sort of imperial language silences and it traps. When Russian imperialists talk about always and never, which they do a lot, they're trying to exercise this form of imperial power. When they say Russia and Ukraine were, quote unquote, always together, or when they say Crimea was always part of Russia, they're saying things which are not only just not true historically, they're also training our minds into a certain kind of way of thinking about the world in which there are great powers and then there's everybody else, and only the great powers matter, and only the great powers get to tell the story. In fact, both Russia and Ukraine are rather new entities, at least as far as national societies are concerned. If anything, the Ukrainian national idea is older than the Russian one. It's pretty easy to trace it back to the Cossacks, which Julia mentioned. In the 17th century, the Cossacks carried out a rebellion against what were then Polish overlords, which was the beginning, I think, of a Ukrainian national idea. From that point forward, most of Ukraine, most of the time, was governed by Russia. And in that sense, she's right that a lot of Ukrainian national thinking has been directed against Moscow. But the story is actually much longer and more interesting than that. Ukraine has connections to basically every moment and every trend in European history. And if I could just add one more thought, what's actually interesting about the present moment is that the Ukrainians are only dealing with the Russians. In the last centuries, Ukrainians have had to deal with Austrians and Germans and Poles, as well as Russian imperialism. And the interesting thing about the moment, and although it's a terrible, terrible moment, this is also a hopeful thing. Right now, the Ukrainians are only having to deal with the Russians. All the other traditional forms of imperialism on their lands are gone. It's just the Russians now.
Well, I think recently you spoke at a panel talking about how Western Europe and the United States have bought into that imperial Russian narrative that you just mentioned there. What's the evidence that you see that Washington and Europe have bought into that narrative, as you put it?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I can give you a few, I mean, obvious examples. Number one is that as someone who teaches this material, I know the textbooks that everyone uses, whether it's in France or Germany, the United States, and in general, they start from the story that, I mean, a version of the story that Putin tells, which is that Russia's been around forever. There was Russia in the year 988. You know, in fact, what happened in 988 was a Scandinavian Viking warlord who came from a company of slave traders, might or might not have been baptized, thereby creating a state which was, you know, spoke all kinds of languages and had nothing to do with contemporary Russia. Moscow didn't exist at the time. It had maybe more to do with contemporary Ukraine because it was based in Kiev, and so it's easier to follow a simple history. But that story of an ancient Russia, which was invented and standardized for 19th century Russian imperial purposes, is pretty broadly spread in our textbooks. Number two is the idea that one should negotiate with Russia because they're the great power, which is very widespread in so-called realist thinking about this war, and unfortunately in some left-wing thinking about this war as well, that Russia's a real country and there's something questionable about Ukraine, like maybe it's corrupt or maybe it's new or maybe they speak too many languages, who knows, we're just not sure who they are. That is evidence that we're in this Russian imperial framework where it's only the center that gets serious attention and the periphery is somehow marginalized or not taken seriously. A third example is everyone's concern about Putin's psychological state, which is one of the strangest things about this war. You only care about the psychological state of a tyrant if you're somehow entranced or hypnotized by the imperial story.
Interesting. Well, but in this case, that particular tyrant also has a nuclear arsenal to hand. So I think that's another reason why there is this sense of being entranced by Putin's psychological state. And that brings us to this question of how the war in Ukraine might end. And we'll pick up with that when we come back with you, Timothy Snyder. Back in a moment. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and Timothy Snyder joins us once again today. He's a professor of history at Yale University, a renowned scholar on Eastern Europe and particularly Ukraine. Back in 2010, he wrote the best-selling Bloodlands, Europe Between Hitler and Stalin. Since then, he's written many other books, including On Tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century, and Our Malady, Lessons in Liberty from a Hospital Diary. And we invited Professor Snyder back to the show today because he recently wrote a piece on his Substack titled, How Does the Russo-Ukrainian War End? So we're going to get his answer to that in a second, but we also wanted to hear more from young Ukrainian Julia Tymoshenko, the 23-year-old whom we heard from at the top of the show. Now, she's in Kyiv, helping to organize resources and raising funds for the Ukrainian military and for civilians directly impacted by the war. She's also got an active social media account, updating her followers on events in Ukraine. Of course, social media being a medium that Ukrainians have so effectively used in the past 8 months. So we asked Julia how she thinks the war might end.
If you're working hard towards something and you know that there is still a long way to go, you don't just like sit down and just speculate, oh, how this might end. I know that there could be lots of outcomes of this. Some of them are scary and horrific, like the discussions about the nuclear use of the nuclear weapon. But for us, we only see this with Ukraine's victory.
Julia says that's not just stubborn patriotism. She says that Ukraine's very survival depends on victory over the Russian military.
We know that if we stop now and we allow them to just rest and recover and regroup and get strength they will attack again.
Once again, let's go to history here, this time more modern history, because in 2014, Russia invaded and annexed Crimea. Pro-Russian separatists began seizing territory in eastern Ukraine. And you might recall that the violence included the shooting down of Malaysian Airlines Flight 17, which killed all 298 people on board. And then in August 2014, Russia invaded eastern Ukraine, and tensions there never fully subsided. That's why, Julia says, the entire nation has been living with anxiety since 2014 about Russia, about what Russia would do next, a fear that's heightened now.
They've been talking about like invading up to Moldova or, you know, invading Ukraine from the north and then like going to Poland. There are all these insane ideas in Russian minds. You just can't allow to have them what they want, because you will show them as well that any other time they can invade again and just chop another piece of land and another piece of land and another piece of land.
And that's why Julia says Ukrainians believe they cannot stop fighting now. Well, Timothy Snyder, you heard Julia there mention the possibility of a horrific nuclear ending to war in Ukraine at the moment. But you just recently wrote that, I'll read this from your Substack, quote, "Speaking of nuclear war in a broad general way, we imagine that the Russo-Ukrainian war is all about us. We feel like the victims. We talk about our fears and anxieties. We write clickbait headlines about the end of the world. But this war is almost certainly not going to end with an exchange of nuclear weapons. What gives you that confidence?
Well, I think first of all, we're kind of out of the habit of thinking about conventional wars and how they proceed, and maybe we're also out of the habit of watching the side that we want to win. And that's what's actually happening here. I mean, the Ukrainians are setting a kind of example of what to do in this situation, which you can actually find in much of what Julia is saying. They were right to anticipate an invasion. They resisted at the beginning when almost no one thought they would. They showed solidarity across society with others. They had a very good defensive plan, which they were able to carry out, and they were able to solicit help from abroad. And now the way that they're fighting, and this is a very important point, is not only admirable but successful. They haven't lost any meaningful territory since March, and they've defended Kyiv and taken back Kyiv region. They've taken back Sumy and Chernihiv regions. They've taken back Snake Island. They've taken back almost all of Kharkiv region. They're advancing in Kherson. So they're winning this war as a result of basically their own actions. And my basic point is that conventional wars end the way that they end. They end when the side, you know, one side or the other or both believes that it's no longer politically sensible to keep fighting. And that's the most likely way for this war to end, is, you know, with a Ukrainian victory which changes politics in Moscow such that Putin is forced to change the subject. I'm happy to talk about why I think nuclear war is not very likely, but I think it's also important for us to keep the focus on the events that are actually taking place, which is the Ukrainians doing very well.
Okay, so we'll come back to the nuclear question then, because I do think it's still on people's minds. But let's talk about what would need to take place in order to, as you just said, change the politics in Moscow? What more would need to happen?
Here I agree with Julia that it's, you know, it's hard to be specific about this kind of prediction, but I accept the traditional Clausewitzian approach to all of this, which is that war is fundamentally political. Putin began this war for basically political aims. He's not going to be able to achieve those aims. And at a certain point, the costs for him politically at home will become great enough that he will have to find a way to change the subject. He'll have to find some kind of a way to pivot. I think if he takes too long, what happens is that his popularity, which is going down, will be a problem. His rivals, who now have much more articulate voices, will feel like they can take even more public stands. The people who have made some kind of career fighting in Ukraine, will also want to have a voice. And he's going to face a situation of a kind of growing oligarchical pluralism around him. And as that struggle for power continues, and in my view, it's already begun, at a certain point, the people involved will not think it makes sense to have troops in Ukraine anymore when there's a struggle for power going on in Russia. That is a normal, I mean, I admit, not as exciting as nuclear war, but that's a normal way for the war to end. And I think that that's the track that we're on.
Mm. So, but what specific costs then might get us further down that track? Because there are already sanctions in place. There are, you know, would those sanctions have to be more extreme for the cost to start mounting up?
Well, I mean, each new horror, I think, should have a response. So the deliberate use of it's now Iranian drones, but deliberate use of distance weaponry to try to make people freeze and starve and be deprived of power over the winter should bring new sanctions. We should be concerned about the presence of, for example, Texas Instruments microchips in the missiles that Russia is launching mm-hmm. to Ukraine. Those things should all be tracked down. But the major source of pressure, to be very clear about this, is a couple more major Ukrainian battlefield victories. That is what we should be aiming for, because that is what will change the political atmosphere in Russia. In this sense, it's really very simple. The Ukrainians are fighting well. They need us as a supply line. If we provide them that, I think they will get those couple more political battlefield victories, and then the politics of this will change.
So I'm thinking about another great power and its failed wars abroad, specifically the United States, right? And our failed wars abroad. My mind is drawn to Afghanistan, but perhaps at this moment, more specifically Vietnam. Because what were the costs that led the United States to finally end its war in Vietnam? There were the more than 55,000 dead Americans. There was the dollar cost of the war, and then, of course, the political cost as well. But I wonder if, unfortunately, deeply unfortunately, the cost will have to be that much higher in Russia because of that long intertwined history that we talked about in the A segment, Tim Snyder. The United States didn't have that long intertwined history with Vietnam, so perhaps it was easier for Americans to say, enough is enough.
I mean, at the bottom line, you know, although we don't like, the Vietnam's really instructive here. Because the bottom line is, of course, that we lost that war. Mm-hmm. But as we withdrew from the war, that's not how we talked about it. And that's what will happen to the Russians. They're not going to say they lost the war. The subject is going to change. And I think the things that will lead them to leave Ukraine are, in fact, pretty similar. They've already lost a lot of the potential mobilizable young men. And their army, unlike Ukraine's, is almost entirely male. Many Russians have already died on the front. Many Russians are fleeing. Many Russians are hiding. The economic costs, which you've already mentioned, are significant. Russia's standing abroad has also been negatively impacted. They've lost most of their friends, and countries that they thought they could dominate in Central Asia are talking to them in a very different way. China is displeased at the way things are turning. India also. So the pressures on Russia are only growing with time. But Vietnam, by the way, is also, it's an instructive example, as is Afghanistan, of a general phenomenon, which is that nuclear powers lose conventional wars all the time. They may not admit that they lose them, but they do lose them, and they don't use nuclear weapons along the way. That was true of the Soviet Union, too.
Mm. Well, I'm thinking about, though, what was left behind in Vietnam, in Korea, even in Afghanistan, but perhaps more specifically in Vietnam and Korea, because, you know, Julia had mentioned before about how since 2014, anxiety and fear of what Russia would do next never really subsided because there was and is a Russian presence in eastern Ukraine. I mean, could we end up with a situation where what Russia withdraws more dramatically because of Ukrainian resistance from much of the country, but there's this forever gaping wound because of its continued presence in eastern Ukraine? And if so, where does that leave Ukraine that's much different from where it was, you know, before February of this year?
Well, I mean, one thing which is very different, I think is worth emphasizing between these other cases in Ukraine, is that in the Ukrainian case, there is a Ukrainian state and a Ukrainian society which unambiguously is fighting a war. And the situation in Afghanistan or even in Vietnam was much more complicated. I mean, here we have one legitimate democratically elected government where popular opinion is on the side of not only fighting the war, but very much on the side of receiving the kind of help from the United States that it's getting. I think in order to minimize the kind of trauma that you're talking about, the most important thing is to end this war as quickly as possible, which means the Ukrainians winning this war as quickly as possible. Because I think fundamentally, Julia is right. The only way this conflict can end is if the Russians realize in some kind of fundamental way that this imperial adventure is over, that Russia is going to have to be built on different principles besides invading Ukraine, that Russia is going to have to decide what it is besides just being the anti-Ukraine, that they have to have some kind of other politics behind besides the politics of us and them. As for the Ukrainians, your question is excellent. I think it's very important for us to understand or remember that a Ukrainian victory also means a Ukrainian recovery, that the Ukrainians need to be offered a future in the European Union. We need to be talking about how the cities are going to be rebuilt. Because again, for the Ukrainians, this is all about the future. They were headed in the right direction. You know, these places where the Russians leave death pits, like Bucha and Irpin, these were suburbs of Kyiv, which were beautiful places where, like, they have parks with forests and where people were looking for better lives. Ukrainians want to get back to that. And part of the victory is us being able to say, yes, we will help you after the victory build some kind of a future. We'll be there to invest and support.
Well, let's hear more now from Julia Tymoshenko, that very, very thoughtful 23-year-old with whom we connected in Kyiv. Now, we had mentioned that she grew up in a village about an hour outside of the Ukrainian capital. Her father and grandparents are still there in that village, and she's been in touch with them. And she asked her father what scared him most about previous times when the village was under Russian occupation.
He was really afraid that we'll be just like occupied and abandoned, and then nobody's going to fight for us here. And he said, like, yeah, but then like I stand like outside and I hear like the silence, and then there is like an artillery shot flying from a side that Ukrainians are. And he was like, yeah, this is good. This that made me feel better. And that's just also such a bizarre thing to realize, that he wasn't as afraid of the fact of all of these like hostilities around us. He was afraid that Ukraine will stop fighting for the village.
Well, now she says many of the people who left at the start of the war have returned, and there's a new rhythm to daily life.
The life in Kyiv is pretty much back to some sort of normal. It's actually really surprising how much people are used to. I think most people came back, so the city is at the same capacity as it was before February 2022. People still drink coffees like outside, going to bars before curfew, because the curfew is at around 11 till 5 a.m. and you need to just stay home. But before that time, everybody just tries to live as normal life as they can.
The reality, though, is just in the past week, Russia has also intensified drone attacks on Kyiv and other regions of Ukraine. And we had to try multiple times to connect with Julia for this interview because of the power blackouts caused by those drone strikes. But when we finally did, Julia talked about Ukrainian resilience.
It's actually pretty amazing, because even after attacks and bombings that happened recently, when the air threat passed and like it was like all clear, people just also went out on the streets that were like bombed. Like, they cleaned the streets and the cafes and everything were back there again the next day.
Julia says, though, her feelings about being resilient like that and the reality Ukrainians are living are quite complicated.
It makes me really proud to be Ukrainian, this like resilience that I see around me, the people just inspire. But at the same time, it makes me really sad that this is something that is becoming so normalized. I get really emotional sometimes seeing this contrast of something horrible happening, but also this beauty of people's resilience and love to life.
Again, that's Julia Tymoshenko, 23 years old, living in Kyiv. We've got about 30 seconds before we have to take our next break, Professor Snyder, but sort of your thoughts on what you've been hearing Julia say.
I mean, what she said about her father is really important. Ukrainians are afraid of the filtration camps and the deportations and the executions and the rape that is associated with Russian occupation. Their right to be afraid of those things, that shapes their attitude towards the war. I understand where her father's coming from.
Well, Timothy Snyder joins us today. He's a professor of history at Yale, a longtime scholar on Eastern Europe and particularly Ukraine. We'll talk with more with Professor Snyder when we come back about how he thinks the war there might end. This is On Point.
Did you kill Marlene Johnson?
I think you're one of the first people to have actually asked.
From WBUR and ZSP Media, this is Beyond All Repair, a new podcast about an unsolved murder that will leave you questioning everything.
Somebody should be in jail for murdering my sister.
A woman who's never been believed.
As long as they think I have done this, then they're not looking for who actually did this.
And that's what makes it a cold case.
No, it's a botched case.
And a search for the truth, once and for all.
Wow, it just gets more interesting.
Beyond All Repair. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts.
Be careful. You're digging in a place that's been very peaceful for a while.
Do it anyway. Dig.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. Timothy Snyder is with us today, professor of history at Yale University, longtime scholar of Eastern Europe and particularly Ukraine. And we're talking about his analysis of how the war in Ukraine, Russia's war in Ukraine, might end. Now, Professor Snyder, we spent quite a bit of time in this conversation so far listening to the deeply thoughtful Julia Tymoshenko, the 23-year-old Ukrainian living in Kyiv. But we also wanted to know a little bit about what young Russians are thinking.
I'm from Moscow, and all my life I've lived in Moscow.
This is 25-year-old Dmitry Grigoryev. He's no longer in Moscow. He's living across the Russian border now in Georgia. Because last month, he decided to check out Georgia just in case he felt that he could not stay in Russia. And then, Professor Snyder, as you noted, Russia announced mobilization plans for young men like Grigoryev.
My position was before the mobilization that I should stay in Russia and to take my responsibility for what's going on there. But the mobilization was the red line. I just needed some free air of freedom to breathe in. You know, Russia became like police and military government very quickly.
And by the way, Timothy Snyder, in his Substack piece, wrote that with mobilization, quote, the distinction between at home and abroad for the Russian people has been broken. And we see that with Dmitry, because what started as a short trip to Georgia now has lasted over a month from him, a month where he has reflected on how his country got here and when he may be able to go home.
Personally, I've realized, and many people realized, that we, the opposition and those who are not supporting this war, that we are not able to win this regime, to fight this regime, strongly. That we realized in March that the protests are being repressed, and etc. And since then, the atmosphere got harder every month. As we know from our history, from like the Soviet Union and from Stalin period, where every like doorbell, which you don't expect, makes you sweat and makes you fear. I know people who were in the army, and the government is looking for them hardly. I mean, calling their relatives, coming to their addresses, and they're hiding. They don't go online, they don't go out on the street, and they sit somewhere like in the house or out of the cities where there are no cameras. For me, it's really difficult. Since, you know, I didn't plan, I wasn't, you know, going away for living. The only thing which helps is that I'm not the only one, you know, I'm not the only one. Here are lots of people who are against the war and from Russia, who came here. Actually, sometimes we even have jokes that it's like a little Moscow or a little St. Petersburg here. You know, it's in the year that Russians are not welcome. Before the war, I've talked quite a lot to those who were for Putin or not against him, and their last argument in supporting him was that when Putin is in power, there would be no war. He is strong enough to keep everything in his like strong hands and not to put our country into the war. And when this last, it was the last and the strongest argument, just broke down one night. I predicted that those people would see that Putin is not our choice, but it didn't happen. I think that after Putin dies, we who don't want dictatorship, who don't want to live in war and in military, would have chance to make changes in Russia. We have many talks about when he dies. We discuss how we're going to celebrate when he dies. I don't exclude the option that I would come back before he dies. I don't know how things are going to be, because, you know, it's a very complex thing to leave your country and have my dog who lives now with my family and etc. It's quite hard, but we don't complain. There are things in Russia and in Ukraine which are going on with people who feel, of course, much more, much harder and much more difficult to live.
That's Dmitry Grigoriev, 25 years old, a Muscovite currently living in Georgia to avoid fighting in the war in Ukraine. Now, Timothy Snyder, Dmitry is thoughtful and brave to have spoken with us. I also just want to state the obvious that he is one voice from a vast country. I wonder what other signs you see that people like Dmitry, beyond the ones who have left, signs within Russia that there might be some kind of new, more notable divide in opinion, in Russian opinion about the Ukrainian war.
Well, number one, we do have one reliable center of public opinion polling, which is the Levada Center. And their polling actually demonstrates that since mobilization, Putin's popularity has gone down. But in particular, people's anxiety about the war has gone up. Mobilization has really changed the way that Russians look at the war. We have that from the data. Second, I'm not sure that Putin's trap, though, is first of all from public opinion. I think the trap that he's got himself in is that having fought this war for so long without winning it, he has people on his right who say, you know, we should do worse things and do them faster. But then he also has people who would like the Russian state to survive and would like their own personal positions to survive because their personal positions are connected to the Russian state. And they want the war to end in some kind of way. He's trying to navigate between those two camps. I don't know how much that longer that can last while the war is still going on. And then was what we talked about before, which is the material basis of this. It's going to be harder and harder for Putin to fight this war with fewer men and with worse and worse equipment.
Mm. Well, you write about how military bloggers, Russian military bloggers who are actually at the front are pushing Putin or writing in a way that is demanding more men, more material to fight, you know, a war that supposedly has a holy cause. And that, in fact, I think you've noted in your Substack that those voices are becoming more mainstream. How is that a trap for Putin?
It's a trap because, in fact, it may be the trap. So the military bloggers are living in the real world in one sense. They see that Russia's losing the war. but they're not living in the real world in another sense. They think that there's some kind of political barrier or just some way that Putin could snap his fingers and produce more men and produce more weapons. They think that somehow, you know, through some act of will or just somehow getting things right or everybody doing their job, the situation with men and weapons could improve. And that's just not true. Russia's already doing everything it can to win this war, and it's failing. And so the military bloggers insisting we have to win, saying that we're losing, that's already a problem for Putin. And then asking him to do something that he can't do because he's already trying to do it, that makes him look weak, and it puts him into a position where he's going to have to look for some other way out, I think. That's how it's a trap.
And you've written about some other prominent Russian political figures who are they openly criticizing Putin, or what are they doing that complicates this moment for him?
I mean, to repeat, the main thing that complicates Putin's moment is the fact that Ukraine is resisting. It's Ukrainian resistance, which then puts various kinds of pressure on the Russian army, the Russian armed forces in general. It puts pressure on Russian propaganda. Russia's a propaganda state, and the story that Ukraine doesn't exist and we've therefore defeated them in 3 days was a great story, but it didn't happen. And so Russian propagandists are now struggling with what kind of story they're supposed to be telling about this war. And there's more and more disagreement, even on Russian propaganda stations, about what's actually going on. That's a problem for Putin. Reality is starting to slip away from the propaganda hold that he has, and propaganda is basically how he runs the country.
Mm. I guess I'm sort of poking at these different parts of what you've written, because it's hard for me to let go of the maybe cynicism isn't the right word, but the observation that that imperial myth that you talked about at the beginning, for any nation that has been enchanted by it, including our own, it's very, very hard to give up, right? I mean, this country stayed in Afghanistan for 20 years with the thought that even through the worst moments where the United States was clearly losing losing ground both politically and in reality in Afghanistan, we still stayed there and poured money in there and took many, many lives for the thought that we would somehow build a democracy there. That's our form of an imperial vision. So I'm just wondering, like, does Russia not have that same staying power in terms of its willingness to be involved with Ukraine?
Let me take a slightly broader view, okay, agreeing with you, as I do, that there are other imperial powers. The history of imperial powers in Europe is that they have to lose a war. We just can't get, that's the elephant here. We just can't get around that. I'm happy to talk about the Russian domestic resistance and about what Dmitry said and so on. But the basic reality is that Germany was an imperial power until it lost the Second World War. France was an imperial power until it lost in Algeria. Spain and Portugal were imperial powers until they couldn't sustain it in Africa. Russia is now at that point where it has to lose. So this is not about us convincing the Russians about their imperial story. It's about them confronting a reality which other imperial powers have had to confront before, which is they can't actually sustain this, that this kind of state model is not the right model for them. But what history shows is that the way that you get there is that you lose the war. And so it's not just in the interest of Ukrainians, although it obviously is, it's also in the interest of Russians that they have a clear defeat in this war, because that gives them a chance, as I think Dmitry is maybe suggesting, to start again on better principles.
Mm. Okay, so that's actually where I want to turn the last bit of the conversation, but I want to also honor the promise that I made to listeners earlier and just hear from you briefly, Professor Snyder, about why you don't think that Putin would use nuclear weapons at all in this war.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're attracted to that version of the end because it's a very clear ending, and because it puts us in the center, it gives us the right to be afraid. But if we listen to Dmitry, if we listen to Russians in general, and I follow social media as best I can, they're not afraid of nuclear war. The Ukrainians are somewhat afraid of nuclear war, but they're resisting Russian nuclear blackmail. And I ask myself, if this is not a big topic in Russia and Ukraine, why should it be a big topic for us? the reason why Putin is talking about this right now is that he's losing the war. This is a bluff meant to shake us up psychologically so that we stop doing the thing that we're doing that helps the Ukrainians win, which is supply them with weapons and other things. The other reason I don't think they'll do it is that it doesn't have very much battlefield utility. If they drop a small weapon or two on Ukraine, the Ukrainian armed forces are very dispersed. This will have huge costs for Ukraine, for Russia. The Chinese and the Indians won't like it. We have things that we will do in response, which are short of a nuclear response, and the Ukrainians will keep fighting. So using a battlefield nuclear weapon will probably accelerate Russia's defeat. Mm-hmm. But maybe a more fundamental point is that what's going on now is called nuclear blackmail. And if you give in to nuclear blackmail, you're actually making nuclear war in general much more likely. Because you're telling the aggressor that this works, you're encouraging other future aggressors to use this tactic, and you're forcing everybody else in the world to build nuclear weapons to defend themselves against future cases of nuclear blackmail. So it's really important not to give in to nuclear blackmail. That's where we are right now.
Okay. So when you said that the history of European imperialism is that European empires have to lose wars in order to withdraw or reduce the scope of their empires. Russia has to lose in this case. The subtext there, I hear you saying, Timothy Snyder, is that that also means that international support of Ukraine has to be maintained. And if not, then what is at stake outside of Ukraine if the international community actually starts turning away from Ukraine itself?
Yeah, I mean, so first of all, this is fundamentally about imperialism, Russian imperialism, but it's about imperialism as a challenge to the world order. The Ukrainians have done an awful lot, not just in their own neck of the woods, but also with respect to China and Taiwan. They've made it seem like it would be a very bad idea for China to try to invade Taiwan, thereby removing the scenario that everyone is worried about for a real kind of world conflict. If we don't help Ukraine to win, we're showing that we're giving away this example of courage. We're giving away this example of dedication, which Julia was talking about. We'd end up with a much darker world where people think it, no matter what risk you take for democracy, democracy isn't going to have a chance because look at the Ukrainians, they lost. We're also looking at a world where a leader like Vladimir Putin, who is repressive across every possible dimension, is going to be in control of Ukrainian food supplies, and where someone who's an oligarch whose wealth is based on selling hydrocarbons is going to have a consolidated and stronger position in the world at a time of global warming when we need to be moving in exactly the opposite direction. So there are a lot of things at stake in this war that go beyond Ukraine itself, important as Ukraine is.
Okay, so we have 1 minute left then, Professor Snyder. And again, it sort of the United States keeps popping up into my mind here. And you said that we have to take risks for democracy. And yet there are many people in this country right now who remember similar messages being said about the United States presence in Afghanistan. And just people saying, well, we're tired of being told that we have to take risks for democracy at great, great cost. That in fact, protecting democracy here at home means, you know, not being so deeply involved militarily, economically, or even possibly politically in other fights for democracy. What would you tell folks who think that now?
There's a basic difference here, which is that Ukraine actually is a democracy and they actually are resisting a tyranny, right? In these other cases, we might have told ourselves stories like that, but those stories, especially in the Iraq War, were lies, and that's on us. We made a mistake. Here we actually have a chance to help other people take risks for democracies. What we are doing in helping Ukrainians to win is reduce the risks for all of us around the world at a very minimal cost to ourselves. This is not a risk, it's a chance, and it would be a shame not to take it.
Well, Timothy Snyder, the Richard C. Levin Professor of History at Yale University, he recently wrote a piece on his Substack titled, How Does the Russo-Ukrainian War End? Professor Snyder, it is always a pleasure to have you on. Thank you so much.
Pleasure is mine. Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.